Morris at Digging on the Traineers in the 50s on 5. Sing the song about Alan Freed, the Moondog. Of course, Alan Freed began in Cleveland at WJW, then moved on out to New York City to WINS, and then over to WABC. Big part of the East Coast radio sound. And this is East Coast Thursday, and it's time to bring on the Baron of the Bronx, Ernie Maresca. Singer, songwriter, and all-around groovy guy. Ernie, welcome to the Night Prowl Show.
Hey, Matt the Cat. Glad to be on.
It is so good to have you on the show, man.
Thanks.
And we are, you know, talking about the East Coast and everything. And, of course, you grew up in the Bronx. What part of the Bronx did you grow up in?
Around Arthur Avenue, 187th Street, Fordham Road. And just what that guy from Brooklyn was talking about. Arthur Avenue's got the best restaurants in the world.
That's what he was saying. That's
yeah,
what...
Mario's, Dominic's. Amici's. Hey, Amici's.
You get up there much nowadays? Or?
Yeah, whenever I get back to New York, that's where you go to eat. I mean, it's great. It's absolutely great.
But you're down
here. Mario's, a lot of people don't know, it makes the greatest pizza there is. You know, but it's a restaurant. Elizabeth Taylor goes there whenever she was able to. A lot of stars.
Hey, look, everyone in New York City says that their place is the best pizza in the city.
Well, I'm telling you, it really is great. I mean, Arthur Avenue is unbelievable for food.
But you're
you
in Florida.
Move out of the neighborhood, but you always go back there for that. It hasn't changed.
You're in Florida now, right?
Yep, Florida.
And it's like New York down there, isn't it? What I mean is,
well, for me, it's great.
The people,
I love it. A lot of people don't like Florida, but I love it. I love it. You know, I'm home. The air conditioner is on, and I'm where I am now. They got some great restaurants, and I love that.
Yeah, what I mean is obviously it's not like New York, except that all the New Yorkers go down to Florida, so you're kind of surrounded by...
Oh, yeah, exactly. There's all New Yorkers here.
Right.
Exactly.
I was in Boca Raton one time and stopped in a deli, and as soon as I walked through the door, it was like I was in New York City.
Yeah,
then
exactly.
Then I stepped out, and it was a whole different story, but... But anyway, let's talk about, you know, getting started. And music must have been a big part of you, you know, your growing up. I mean, did you hear music on the street corner? Was it radio? Was it, you know, records? I mean, what got you interested in music in general?
Well, in my day, everyone was singing on street corners and starting a group and going to the hallways for an echo sound and singing in subways and whatnot. And we used to go out to, like, I mean, Jersey or somewhere to hear these stations that were playing music that you're playing now, Buddy Spaniels and things like that. And I started writing songs, and everyone had a group, and I was in a group with the Regents that we started. And then I cut a demo called No One Knows, and I put it up in the pool room, which is on Quatona Avenue, Tally's pool room. And Dion used to go there, and he heard this demo of a song called No One Knows, and he liked it. And he wanted to know who did this demo, so on and so forth. And then I got to meet him, and he liked the song so much. And he took me downtown, and I got to meet Gene and Bob Schwartz from Lori Records, and he recorded No One Knows. When I cut it, it was a different song. We had to change the lyric. I made it just fooling around, you know, like, No One Knows what I go through, but it was a different kind of lyric.
Do you remember the lyric?
Yeah, it was, I grew up on Garden Street. It was Garden Street where I come from. All the girls are a bunch of bums, what can I tell you? But anyway, we had a...
It was the melody. It was the melody that sold the record, right?
Yeah. But then we did a good lyric, and... But that's what we did. So in those days, we all got together in hallways and started groups, and everybody was singing, and Dion was the first one in the neighborhood. A lot of guys came out from there. Bobby Darin was from that neighborhood. A lot of groups, the Earls, Chance, what's his name? And the Earls, and a whole bunch of groups. It was really good.
Right. Now, explain to me about this pool hall, though. Now, you put it, when you say you put it up in the pool hall.
They had a jukebox there.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I cut a demo.
All right. So you put, like, you cut, like, an acetate or something?
Yeah, that's what it was.
All right. And so you put it in the jukebox.
Well, I went up to the owner, and I said, could you get this in the jukebox? He says, yeah. So you put it in the jukebox, and it was playing, and Dion went up there. In those days, used to play a lot of pool and things like that.
Yeah.
And so you happen to hear it, and he liked the song. And he said, hey, what is that? You know. And so he found me, tracked me down, and then I got to know him because I didn't know him. In those days, they had gangs. They had the Fordham Ballies, the Imperial Hoods. Everybody had teenage gangs and things like that, you know.
Were you part of a gang?
Well, I guess you had to be. Who the hell knows? The Holy Crosses, the Fordham Diggers, everybody was part of some gang.
Right.
You know. And everybody was afraid of the gangs, you know, because the older guys were the real Fordham bullies. You know, they were like everybody, hey. You know, they were like in their late 20s. They were like really old.
Yeah.
We were like 16, 17. You know, the original bullies, you know.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, they made a movie about it. They called it The Wanderers.
Yeah, for late 70s.
Yeah, but the bullies weren't like that. Oh. And the movie they had them with no hair and all that, they weren't like that. These right. guys were like older. Like me, they were tough guys. I mean,
was Dion a tough guy?
Not really. No? I mean, none of us were really tough guys. I mean, it was, I mean, you know, in those days, I mean, the tough guys were, well, they're all in jail. Yeah. Dion's not in jail.
Now you live, now the irony of the whole thing is that now you live close to Dion down in Florida.
It's funny. He moved to Florida about 40 years ago, and I talked to him occasionally on the phone, so on and so forth. And I moved to Florida, to Boca Raton, about 10 years ago. And one Sunday when I went to Mass, who did I meet at Mass? Dion. It was incredible.
That's crazy.
So I moved to Pompano, where I live now, which is about a half hour away from Boca Raton, about 3 years ago, because they got more restaurants here, and I liked it better. We're in a house there, which I didn't really like that much, so I'm better off now. But I talk to Dion every once, twice a month and everything. He's still real good. You know, we wrote a lot of songs together, Dion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it all goes back to No One Knows.
Yeah, actually, that was how it started, and then I did a Lover's Prayer.
Yeah.
After that, another song of mine, and then he didn't have a couple of hits for a while, and then Gene Schwartz got us together, and he said, why don't you guys do something a little bit up-tempo on that, because Laurie tried a lot of things with Dion, and it wasn't working out after he broke up with the Belmonts. You know, the Belmonts started their own label, and so on and so forth, and Dion and I wrote Run Around Sue, and he cut it, and they were going to release it, and Gene said, no, I'm not going to release this version. And he went in and recut it and came out in the court right on, went right to number one, which was great.
We're going to talk about what was changed in just a moment, but first, let's hear how it all started with No One Knows.
Oh.
Dion and the Belmonts, written by my guest, Ernie Maresca. It's the Night Prowl Show.
No one knows what I go through, and the tears I cry for you.
Sue Dion on the 50s on 5, of course, released on Laurie Records. And my guest is a guy who worked with Laurie Records for a long time. He also wrote that song for Dion, Ernie Maresca. Welcome back to the show.
Here I am. By the way, that was Larry Chance and the Earls. I couldn't think of it.
Right from the Bronx.
Yeah, great group.
Absolutely. Great. Play them all the time here on the show. Let's talk about now the, you said that they wouldn't release Run Around Sue in its original state. What happened? What changed?
Well, what he did was he had it too fast. He went in and he slowed it down. He made it like, I mean, much slower than it was. And people thought Gene was crazy. Gene was the owner of the company, and he was the A&R man. He was a great A&R man. He cut all these sides, Teenager in Love, so many things. He picked up the master to Petite Floor and Morgan, the German record. He got Gary U.S. Barnes to come to the label to be the record distributor of that. He caught right on to a lot of things. He was great. And they were all set to release Run Around Sue. Everybody thought it was a hit the way it was, except Gene. And it wouldn't have been a hit if it came out the way it was. It was too fast. And he slowed it down like maybe almost two tempos to what it was. It was that fast. And when we played it compared to what caught right on. It was like night and day.
Do you remember writing it?
Yeah. Like, we wrote it in the schoolyard, me and Dion.
So was it about anyone specific, or is it just...
Well, his wife's name is Sue.
Yeah.
But actually, she wasn't run around. She's a nice girl. I talk to her all the time. But we wanted to write about something, and, you know, I guess he wanted to write about his whole family. Later, we wrote about Donna. That was his sister. So, you know, so, yeah, we needed a name, and Sue sounded good. And I had just written a song called Runaround by the Regents.
Right, yes.
That was a hit about a year ago or something like that. And so I said, how about doing, like, Runaround Sue? You know, and Dan always liked that other thing. We played around with it, and we went to Laurie the next day, and we showed it to them. And they said, it's great. And they went into the studio, and they recorded it. And we all thought it was great. And they came back, and they played it in that room that Gene had over there. Billy Vera will probably know the room. And it was, like, too fast, you know.
Yeah.
And Gene is the only one that really knew that. I mean, he was incredible. He had a tremendous ear for music. And he said, no, I'm not going to release this the way it is. I got to go in and recut it. We said, what, are you crazy? And he went in and he recut it, and he was right. He slowed it down to two tempos or something like that. It was really fast. It was too fast.
Wow.
Yeah, now, it was amazing.
Now, what about the Del Satins getting the background male harmony part going?
Well, Del Satins were fantastic. By the way, Dion was great because Dion taught a lot of these parts to the groups, you know, before they came up. But the Del Satins are fantastic, number one. Number two, Laurie had to get a group to back Dion up because the Belmonts left. He broke up with the Belmonts. They started their own record company, and they got the Del Satins to back him up. And they were cutting the Del Satins anyway, Laurie. They had a few singles out with them. I'm trying to remember, Teardrops Follow Me and
right.
things like that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were great, a great group. And so Dion went in with them. And the Del Satins are the most underrated group there is. I mean, they even backed me up on Shout Shout.
Those are the guys?
Yeah, they were.
Those are the guys?
They were great. Who the hell knows what else they did? I mean, they were absolutely great.
Right. Hey, I got a question from the roller coaster in Linden, New Jersey. He wants to ask you about Bobby Darin.
Yeah.
Did you know him coming up?
Let me tell you something about that, about Bobby Darin. When I used to show songs around or send out demos, acetates, as you call them, a lot of people didn't even answer. Bobby Darin always wrote a letter, signed it, always gave a good response. I just missed him one day coming out of the Brooklyn and getting into a limo, you know, when I first started in 1958 or whatever. I was going to jump into the limo because that's what you had to do, and I couldn't get to him. But other than that, I never met him. I went to see him. I never really cared about him until I went to see him at the Cope. It was incredible. I went back twice.
Yeah.
I took my whole family, my mother, may she rest in peace, my sisters, and so on and so forth. That's how good he was. And then I used to send him demos, and he was, like, incredible. I'm sorry that I never got to know him. Because he always answered, always wrote back a personal letter saying, this is pretty good, send it back. This is before I even had Run Around Sue. And then even after I had Run Around Sue and The Wanderer, I would send things out. He had his own publishing company and all that. Because don't forget, I worked for a record company. They weren't publishers. You know, and but he always answered. He was one of the few guys that always did that. He was great,
so
absolutely great. And I became a great Bobby Darin fan.
Who published your songs then?
Well, it was Schwartz Music, which was Laurie Records. Then they had Rust Enterprise, they had a BMI firm and a firm for the other one, society.
Do you still have
ASCAP? Pardon me?
Do you still have the rights to your songs?
ASCAP and BMI. Yeah, we got the rights. I got a great lawyer, Guy Blake, that handles everything for me, and
good.
Is taking care of the whole situation. But in the early days, I mean, I didn't have things like that, and you had to if you didn't have a lawyer or you didn't know what you were doing. You know, you could really get stuck.
So how are you actually making money then? Let's say it's 1961. How are you paying the bills?
That's when I stuck with Laurie. When I went there and I asked them for advances, they gave it to me. For instance, I asked for an advance on The Wanderer. That's the only reason why it got recorded. in the album. I showed that song to everybody in the business, and everybody turned it down.
Really? It seems like such a natural
everybody
song.
Everybody turned it down. I went up to Lori. I got Gene Schwartz. He gave me a $75 advance for The Wanderer, and it would have probably never came out. And they were cutting an album, and they were doing the Runaround Seuss thing with Dion. And I said, Gene, do it. And maybe you put it in an album, make back your $75. Don't forget, 1961 or whatever it was, that was a lot of money, $75 or whatever.
But you weren't signing you weren't giving the song away, were you?
No, I signed it. I signed it to the publisher.
I see.
You know,
okay.
A writer has nothing to say. Once the publisher has the song, especially in those days, it doesn't mean a darn thing. Because when Michael Jackson got the publishing, for instance, about 20 years ago, he bought the publishing from Lori, okay? Mm-hmm. And they were going to do a toilet paper commercial in Japan.
Mm. You know,
and Michael Jackson, who's making about $20 million a year, they were willing to pay, I think, about $150,000 for the commercial. He turned it down. He didn't want the song to be in a commercial. And even though I wrote the song before he was born,
yeah,
I had nothing to say about it because
wow,
he was the publisher. So that's wrong. But now I am the publisher on certain songs. I do have a good lawyer, Guy Blake, representing me and so on.
So are we going to have The Wanderer in a toilet paper commercial anytime soon?
Well, I don't publish it.
Oh.
He still has it. But believe me, if I published it, they could do all the toilet paper they want in Japan. I'll take the $150. What do I care? You know what I mean? I should worry about those little kids instead of my toilet paper.
Exactly.
But anyway.
All right. Well, if anyone else would like to, if any other Night Prowler would like to ask Ernie Maresca a question, it's MattTheCat@XMRadio.com.
Matt the Cat, my man.
Well, let's talk about The Wanderer. You brought it up. So nobody wanted to publish this song or record this song.
Yeah, and then
who turned it down? Who turned it down? Give me a list of names right now.
In those days, you would go to the music publishers. You would go to Hill and Range. You would go to Bourne Music. You would go to Acuff Road.
Did you want Elvis to record it? Because he could have done it.
If you wanted Elvis to maybe record it, you had to go to Hill and Range.
Right.
Or, and I didn't care because I gave them the publishing. I didn't really care. I just wanted somebody to take it or at least give me the $75 so I get some money back for that it cost me to make the acetate, as you called it, which is what it was in those days.
All right.
So Gene gave me the money, and they recorded and they put it on the flip side of the Majestic to get their advance back.
And they own the publishing on the Majestic, too.
Yeah, they own the publishing.
Because something I learned a little while ago that I didn't realize is that if a record is rising up the charts and it's selling, that both sides, both publishers on either side of the record get an equal split.
Yeah,
so,
but not the performance. The performance is where the money is, especially in those days. Every time that the song got played, you would get paid. So in those days, when you were making a penny a record, if you sold a million copies, you would make $10,000 for writing The Wanderer if it was the hit. And if you were on the other side, you would make the same amount of money for writing The Majestic because you would both get a penny. Because that's what it was in those days. It was a penny. Actually, you would get less because the publisher would get a penny, and if he was honest, he would pay the writer a half a penny. Now it's about, I think, 7 cents or 8 cents.
Oh, that's
and
horrible.
Sometimes they do statutory, 3/4 of statutory, so you're lucky if you get 6 cents, and which means that you would get 3 cents, and if you were a dishonest publisher, which... who knows
most
what you get paid on, you're lucky if you get 2 cents. But all the money is in performances. Every time the song is played or on TV or on whatever, or if you get lucky to get in a commercial or whatever.
Mm. But when you originally wrote The Wanderer, it had a line that was changed.
Yeah, well, it used to be with my two fists of iron and my bottle of beer.
So bottle of beer was too much, too suggestive.
Yeah, well, it makes sense if you listen to the song.
Sure.
And they made it, and I'm going nowhere. So I said, this don't make no sense to me. But I wasn't about to say, no, you can't do the song.
Right. Well, I mean, it's, you know, The Wanderer is a tough guy. And if he's saying, you know, I got my two fists of iron and I'm going nowhere, it's like he's putting himself down.
It's slow on my right arm, merry on my left. You know. And
he tears open his shirt and it's Rosie on his chest, right?
Yeah.
All right, well, let's play The Wanderer, huh?
All right, go ahead.
1962, written by Ernie Maresca, my guest on this East Coast Thursday Night Prowl show.
Oh, and I'm the type of guy.
all my mind.